And thank you, Erica, for having me here at this wonderful and inspiring meeting. I think I'll try the pointer. Okay, it doesn't work. That guy was right. I'll be here.
Okay.
You understand me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. This is about hearing or listening, I will start with listening to some music. The beginning of a composition called Tamarind Serenade by David Tay. And you can ask yourself, did you respond affectively to this music? Following the findings by David Tay and his co-researcher, psychologist David Snowden, you probably would have responded positively if you were a cotton top tamarind. And forgive me this visual pun. In German, cotton top tamarinds are called Listäffchen, list monkeys. They are named after this famous composer and pianist, Franz Liszt. Not yet having known about this tamarind's responsiveness to music, the name is obviously derived from a visual analogy. I will come back to Snowden's and Tay's paper later on. But first, I would like to contextualize their endeavor. Their endeavor is playing human music to non-human animals for the purpose of scientific research in a framework of musicology and the sciences. Many definitions, and I can catch up with Susanne here, many definitions of music place it in the realm of human exceptionalism. In this view, music is an art only humans can master and can enjoy. Alternatively, music, as we just have heard, can be seen as something non-human animals are capable of. And from this point of view, music can even be a medium of interspecies communication. The theoretical discussions about these propositions are interesting, but they are not in the center of my presentation today. I would like to focus on more, you could say, bottom-up empirical approaches to music. I think one can avoid the big questions like, do animals have music? One can avoid those questions and conduct research on quite concrete and specific practices of music making and of listening to music. But even in these cases, some of the fundamentals and prerequisites of this scholarly or scientific work are shaky. And one reason for that problem may lie in the history of our academic approaches to music. Historically, the classical subjects of music research are humans. Humans can speculate verbally about aesthetics, they can write down scores of music compositions, and they can report verbally about their experiences while listening to music. And so musicologists often are hesitant to turn to non-humans as their subjects of research. So non-human animals do not deliver verbal reports and they probably do not write down scores. Nevertheless, there are quite obviously many phenomena that connect animals and music, and different animals are said to sing. We had songbirds, here we have the whale song. They are said to dance, like the lyrebird, or to drum. This is a recent study about a captive chimpanzee who burst into a spontaneous performance of drumming. Well, if research is done on those phenomena, interestingly, most of the time it is carried out by scientists, not by scholars from the field of musicology. And there have been fascinating findings concerning similarities of animal sound production and human music. We have just had examples of this. It's even the case that quite a lot of human music is influenced, or has been influenced and has been inspired by animal song, especially by bird song. But as we are supposed to concentrate on hearing this time, I will leave out now questions of animal music and of the human imitation of animal music, because non-human animals can not only produce sounds, but they can be exposed to human sound production as well. And the situation I'm interested in right now is humans that make animals listen to music, to human music. Sometimes this occurs in the natural habitats of the animals. But as we all know, science is fond of controlled experiments in a controlled environment. So in the cases when music is played to animals as a scientific experiment, not as an artistic experiment, lab animals are the prevalent listeners. And I will now try to, in a way, deconstruct some of the studies that have been carried out in this area during the last 20 years. Doing this, I try to follow an interdisciplinary approach. I, as a musicologist, am reading the scientific studies from a point of view of musicology. And not surprisingly, I sometimes have a bit critical approach to what you could call the positivistic stance of the natural sciences. But at the same time, I have to admit that biology has ventured into areas of research where musicology has mostly refrained to enter. Just to give you an impression what has been going on in the last 20 years, I show you a small selection of scientific publications on animals listening to music in the lab. You don't have to read everything, but you see that it ranges from here the effect of different frequencies of music on blood pressure regulation in spontaneously hypertensive rats to, I like this one and I will talk about it later, chimpanzees prefer African and Indian music over silence. If human music is played to non-human animals in the lab, some interesting questions are raised. For example, what kind of music do the scientists, who usually have no professional training in music, use? And why? As musical styles differ vastly, this seems to be a central issue of the experimental setting. But astonishingly, sometimes this important question, what kind of music, remains just unanswered. Kim and colleagues, 2006, published a paper on the influence of prenatal noise and music on the spatial memory and neurogenesis in the hippocampus of developing rats. On their materials and methods, they write, the noise-applied rats were exposed to the 95 dB supersonic machine sound for 1 hour, once a day, until delivery. The unborn rats, until delivery. The music-applied rats were exposed to the 65 dB comfortable music sound for 1 hour once a day until delivery. Control rats were left undisturbed. After birth, the offspring were left undisturbed together with their mother. The spatial learning test was performed on the 21 days after birth. Animals were sacrificed immediately after the completion of the spatial learning test. Unquote. This passage documents a whole lot of complex problems, methodical problems, the noise just being so much louder than the music, 95 dB is quite loud, and ethical problems, the rats being sacrificed. Right now, I just would like to point out that comfortable music sound could mean anything here. Many other means and parameters of the experiment, for example, the radial arm maze apparatus for the spatial learning test, and the solution in which the removed brains of the rats were transferred for cryoprotection are documented in detail in the study. And it is remarkable that we as readers then are left alone to speculate whether comfortable music sound stands for Mozart, Madonna, Motorhead, whatever. Moreover, this phrase suggests that it is obvious and undisputable what kind of music is comfortable. Anyone who has been listening to a Wagner opera or a punk rock concert should have recognized that the same music can be comfortable for some and quite uncomfortable for others. Among many other factors, also depending on the volume of the music, as already said. Loud music is a different one. I now turn to another question that comes up with many of the mentioned studies. What is the reason that music is presented to the animals at all? It seems that some of the studies try to solve some fundamental problems of music research by conducting experiments on non-human animals. The idea of the model organism behind that. I will give you some of these fundamental problems of musicology. The relationship of music and cognition. Music in this context is interpreted as a training for certain cognitive abilities, for spatial temporal abilities, numerical abilities, and so on. You could put it down in the simple hypothesis, music helps us think. Another fundamental problem, the relationship of music and affect. Music here is seen as a kind of trigger for affective responses, as with the tamarinds. Simply put, music makes us feel something. And the relationship of music and sociality. It could be formulated as music forms groups. Perhaps this very interesting issue is not so important here, because it often involves active participation of musical actors. And actually, the setting of many of the analyzed experiments here and the musical style of the playback material tells us a lot about the aesthetical preferences of the human experimenters. Because not only is the situation of the lab experiment itself a very Western framing, but the idea that we separate musical actors as musicians, as was said in the discussion, who are active, we separate them from listeners who are more passive and reactive, is a very Eurocentric concept in itself. The animals are constructed as listeners in a Western modern mode, which is quite alien to most of human music cultures. And this is a general flaw of this lab experiment approach. For example, in a study from 2007, Vidian and colleagues ask, quote, is music just noise and thus potentially harmful to laboratory animals, or can it have a beneficial effect, unquote. But they base their answer exclusively on Western music, comparing classical and easy listening vocal and instrumental music. There have only been a few studies that have substituted the affluent use of Western classical or popular music by music from non-Western cultures. Mingle and colleagues in 2014 exposed chimpanzees to West African, North Indian, and Japanese music. Their conclusion, I quote, when exposed to three different types of world music, chimpanzees spent more time in areas closest to the source of Indian and African music, suggesting a preference for both music types over silence. Furthermore, these preferences were stable throughout the experimental period, suggesting that they were not simply caused by stimulus novelty. This observed preference for any type of music is in direct contrast to previous literature in which primates preferred silence to Western music. By considering only Western music, previous research has limited itself to a small set of acoustic features. The key difference is that the current study focused the investigation on world music with different non-Western acoustic parameters. End of quote. I have to say that a perhaps unconscious bias against non-Western music being constructed as more natural or more animal-like than European music lures in the background here. Yeah? There's a slight problem, but at least they managed to avoid the methodological flaw of the study of, for example, Kim and colleagues that was mentioned above, by adjusting the different playbacks to the same modest volume threshold. They adjusted the tempo of the examples. Quote, the original West African, Akan, and North Indian raga pieces were used in their entirety, and the Japanese piece was used from the 19th second mark through the end. The tempo of each piece was adjusted so that they maintained an identical bass tempo of 19 beats per minute, then looped to create 40 minutes of continuous music. Additionally, the volume of the music was standardized at 50 dB, so that all the music maintained the same average amplitude. In general, and turning to the aspect of responsiveness, one could ask, do the animals react or respond to the music they hear? And if so, do they seem to enjoy it? It maybe does not surprise you that there is no general answer to these questions. The levels of response, of reaction, and the methods of measurement are very diverse. The methods range from observing behavior, for example, rhythmic movement of the animals, among measuring, for example, dopamine levels, until killing all involved animals and analyzing their neuronal structures. A behavioral approach was chosen by Watanabe and Nimoto. In their paper from 1989, they documented that some Java sparrows showed preferences for certain musical styles. So the birds could choose between music from the 18th and the 20th century, like Baroque and modern compositions. And I won't tell you which one they prefer. Another way to measure responsiveness behaviorally is to look for rhythmic movement by the animals who listen to music. And this is especially interesting as entrainment, which means synchronizing to a steady beat by movements like tapping, nodding, swaying for a longer time, was seen as an exclusively human ability. In 2013, a stranded sea lion named Ronan was trained by Peter Cook and colleagues to entrain to Western pop music. I will show you a short video clip.
When we first trained Ronan, we used a simple repeating sound, something like a metronome. Once she had learned, without further training, Ronan was able to find and keep the beat in complex stimuli, including music. When beekeeping had been seen only in humans and some parrots, people thought that vocal mimicry might actually be a necessary precondition for rhythmic ability. But our findings with Ronan, who as a sea lion is not a vocal mimic, challenge that theory. It may be that rhythmic ability is much more widespread in the animal kingdom than previously thought.
On the other hand, many of the experimental settings, especially in medical and neurophysiological research, involve things like genetically manufacturing diseases, interfering with growth and development of unborn and born animals, putting extreme stress on the subjects and killing them in the end. Bastien Desprez, in her 2004 article, The Body We Care For, writes about a famous experiment on lab rats by Rosenthal. Quote, as long as this practice proposes new ways to behave, new identities, it transforms both the scientist and the rat. Both the student and the rat transform the practice that articulates them into what we may call an anthropozoogenetic practice, a practice that constructs animal and human. Unquote. But she adds, in relation to another experiment, Harlow executed on a rhesus monkey, quote, by contrast, we may say that the rhesus monkey, literally tortured by Harlow, could hardly find means to resist the apparatus and the questions that are addressed to him, her, unquote. The experiments on animals hearing music span this whole range, and Desprez addresses this in the following citation. The contrast between a scientist who relies on the availability of both the apparatus and the animal and a scientist who requires docility, this scientist being himself docile to the perceived prerequisites of science, may be translated along another contrast, the contrast between the manner of addressing oneself to the system, on the one hand as a caretaker, as somebody interested in its possible becoming, and on the other hand as a judge or a master. In the first case, the animal is what articulates the system. In the other, it is the system that articulates the animal, which just has to show how it obeys laws. Unquote. Most of the studies we were dealing with right now are falling in one of those two categories. It hopefully has become clear that there is a complex relationship between the discussed scientific approaches and their implicit aesthetical fundaments. Moreover, many of the experiments raise grave ethical questions. Donna Haraway, in When Species Meet, cites Sharon Gamari Tabrizi as following, quote, "It's much easier to make use of a notion of trans-species relationality in field studies, where the scientist, Noah, can hang out in the animal's habitat. But the harder question is, when the site is wholly humanly constructed, where the lab is a total environment. In the lab, not only is the relationship unequal and asymmetrical, it is wholly framed and justified, legitimated and meaningful within the rationalist materials of early modern humanism," unquote. This almost perfectly describes the methodological as well as the ethical challenges of the discussed studies. Haraway's answer to Gamari Tabrizi does not provide an easy solution. She says, yes, all the calculations still apply. Yes, I will defend animal killing for reasons and in detailed material semiotic conditions that I judge tolerable because of a greater good calculation. And no, that is never enough, unquote. Haraway herself cites Mark Beckhoff with his make or break question, does the research benefit the animals? I would be happy to discuss possible answers as far as the presented studies are concerned with you, but before ending, I briefly return to David Tay's Tamarind Serenade. Based on the finding that tamarinds preferred silence to pre-existent human music, Snowden and Tay decided to compose tamarinesque music pieces. This is what we heard in the beginning. Pieces that make use of typical frequencies and typical rhythmic structures of tamarind vocalizations. The tamarinds in the experiment preferred these species-specific compositions to silence. Thank you for listening.